Welcome to the Sonic Nuance Electronics Podcast, focusing on topics of interest to worship teams as well as anyone involved with musical recording and performance. Today's interview is with Scott Taylor, worship pastor at Resonate Church in Fremont, California. All right, Scott, growing up, what music inspired you and made you fall in love with the art form?
Yeah, that's easy for me. Even sitting at my desk right now, I can look at my wall and I have a vinyl album, back when they were called albums, before tapes or CDs were ever invented, because I'm that old. I have the actual vinyl framed and hanging on my wall, and it's of Keith Green. And I remember as a young boy putting that album on and playing it over and over. I still have the vinyl in, it's framed in that case, but I'm not sure if it plays because it might be worn out. I played it so much. And what I loved about Keith Green was that he genuinely was in love with God, and he had this message of grace that we just cannot be good enough for God to love us, but yet he somehow communicated that love for God and that message of grace with just an intense passion, and it came through the music. So I felt like he was talking to me while I was listening to him and listening to him sing these songs. And I see even now like such a profound influence that had on me, and even the way I think about worship leading, where we want our heart to be communicated to people. We want them to feel that God loves them as we lead. And Keith Green was my number one influence as growing up.
Great. So this is probably going to answer my question, but can you tell me at what point in your life you knew you wanted to become a worship pastor?
Yeah. It sort of snuck up on me. I had gone on a mission trip when I was 16 years old, where I did evangelism and shared the gospel with people. And I came back from that at 16 and said, I want to be in full-time ministry. Like, I want to just dedicate my life to this. But I never even thought about being a worship pastor. It didn't even cross my mind. I just played four chords on the guitar. That's all I knew at the time. I was going to be a youth pastor or a missionary, but music just didn't enter my thoughts at that time. But then our youth group got together and said, hey, we need someone to lead worship for us. So they bought me a guitar, put it in my hands, and I started playing G, C, D, and E minor and leading songs for the youth group. And God just kept putting me in places like that over and over throughout high school and college. I kept leading worship for different groups. And then I graduated. I was a youth pastor in a church, and I went away on a mission trip. I took the kids on a mission trip, and on that mission trip, I felt God specifically calling me to be a worship pastor, and it almost startled me. You know, I loved music. I loved every time I led worship, but I was still sort of set on being, you know, like a youth pastor or maybe a lead pastor somewhere. And then now all of a sudden God just confirmed that he wanted me to use music to impact people. And it was a week later that I went into the office as a youth pastor, and the senior pastor of that church called me into his office and asked me. He said that our current worship pastor was leaving for personal reasons, and the senior pastor asked me if I would step into the role of worship pastor for that church.
What a coincidence.
Way back in Michigan. So,
what coincidence.
That? Yeah, it was a coincidence, you know, 8 days after I got back, you know. So I would say at that point I knew, hey, this is what God wants for me.
All right. You normally lead bands from the guitar. Do you have a preference of acoustic or electric, and why?
Yeah, I've been on a journey in regard to which of those two instruments, acoustic or electric, to use in the worship band setting. And I do have a preference now. It's sort of evolved over the years of playing in bands. When I started, I thought and felt like acoustic guitar was the only way to go. I felt like I had a good sense of controlling the rhythm, controlling the tempo, setting up songs, and I felt like electric guitars sometimes are too soupy or just don't have that same rhythmic hold on the band that an acoustic guitar mm-hmm. does. But I think it's because I was playing with bands that weren't as great musically. And over the years, I've found myself playing with better and better musicians. And that sense of trying to hold on to the rhythm of the song is not needed when you have an incredible rhythm section underneath you. So in recent years, especially my time at Resonate Church, we've been playing with such talented musicians. I vastly prefer playing with electric guitar now because of the versatility of the electric guitar, because of the dynamic power that the electric guitar has, as you just can shift and add to your tone. I think the rhythm guitar, instead of holding everything rhythmically now, I use it as like a dynamic volume pedal. I get to just really add in great dynamics and feel with the rhythm guitar. And that's made possible by playing with really, really talented musicians. But that would clearly be my winner now.
And tell me a little bit about your guitars.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm spoiled about that. You wanted me to talk about the instruments themselves?
Sure.
Okay. It's one of my favorite subjects because different people have hobbies, right? And so everyone's, you know, some guy might, his hobby is scuba diving, or somebody else likes, you know, I don't know, basket weaving. But my hobby is guitars. And I think people don't realize that because it's also my livelihood. So they just assume they can't be the same. But I get all excited when I talk about guitars. I'm so spoiled. I have some instruments that are just I'm not good enough to play them. Basically, they belong in like cases in a museum or something. But instead, I get to use them to lead worship. For an acoustic, I have a Taylor 614. It's all maple with the Sitka spruce top, ebony fretboard. I love the maple wood because it's got a really even response tone. And so it's not like really bassy or really trebly. It's really flat. And I find when I'm leading on stage that that's the kind of tone that I really want. Most of my friends who are involved in front of house prefer my guitar to almost every other one. It's got great pickups in it. Just the sound coming up from the stage is fantastic. I love it. I actually, when I go into Guitar Center, I don't feel like buying another acoustic. I would rather the one I have.
That's a good feeling.
It's a great feeling. Oh, and I'd say the same with electric guitars. I've evolved through about four different electric guitars and ended up getting I wanted the two humbuckers on rhythm guitar. I wanted a fat, growly sound. So I went with a Les Paul. So I actually saved my pennies and bought a Gibson Les Paul standard. I really like it. It has an asymmetrical neck design that just fits my hand right, so the action feels good to me. The two humbuckers give a really fat, powerful sound. Intonation is great because it's got a fixed bridge. It's got locking tuners. And the new Gibson standards even have a locking jack for your quarter-inch input, so that doesn't even get unplugged when I accidentally step on my cable on stage. I love the guitar, and I would play it every week, except for my 40th birthday, I was given a Gretsch White Falcon. And so now I have a hollow body guitar that is, you have to know what a White Falcon is. It's absolutely a work of art, just the most versatile guitar I've ever played. And I haven't found what it can't do as far as tone-wise. It just spreads the spectrum. I think what I like best about it is because it is a hollow body, I can have my quiet songs play almost acoustic, open feeling, but then when I drop it into a distortion, the pickups, the brightness, I love it. I can't play it enough. So my Les Paul has not been getting much love since I got the White Falcon. and it's probably going to stay that way for the future,
yeah,
too.
It's a gorgeous guitar, both visually and sonically. I love that thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Can you describe for me the process of picking songs for, let's say, a recent set list? So what was that like?
Yeah. I think the important thing to remember is the goal of Sunday isn't the songs. That actually there's something much bigger going on, and the goal is that people encounter God, right? So the way that the different elements of the service work together, I liken it almost to a recipe. And there, you have to have different ingredients in order to get the cake to turn out the right way. And so there are different ingredients that over time we realize putting these ingredients together ends in a cake that is just magnificent. And so in selecting songs, I never do that in isolation, but I always think about how the songs impact with the other ingredients of that worship service. It has to work together. It can't just be the songs alone. So there are, I think, sometimes where worship leaders just choose songs that they love or that they want to play or even that the band loves or the band could really do a great job on. But all of those considerations for me are secondary to how are these songs going to work in conjunction with everything else that's going to be taking place at that moment and really crafting the service to have the most powerful environment that we can for worship, for people to see God. So that has to start really in conjunction with the pastor, whoever's going to be teaching, and really understanding the vision and the burden that God's given them for the text that they're going to be using and the message that will be shared. That is the starting point, and then crafting the rest of the service around that direction. So I always begin with finding out from the pastor what is going to be the topic, what's the text. I'll usually read through the text several times throughout the week, a couple weeks before.
The Bible text or the...
Yep, the biblical passage, whatever Bible. I'll read the chapter or the couple chapters. If it's a small book of the Bible, I'll read the whole book. Just praying over and asking God to speak to me. And often that leads me to a couple songs that I feel like I just cannot wait to play these songs, because I know when our people hear this biblical text and have these words to use as their own vocabulary, the words from this song, it's really going to be an explosive moment. Then after, I usually will end up with one or two songs from just that kind of meditation on the passage, and then I'll begin thinking through what other ingredients do we need. Do we need a song, sort of the liturgy of the service? Do we need a call to worship then, or do we need a moment of confession? And I'll look for songs that sort of fit into the liturgy in that way, and then I take into consideration what the band is capable of, how many new songs are going to be shared that Sunday. And I'll sort of massage it until I end up with what I feel are the best songs for that service.
In that sense, what do you find is the importance of having singable songs for a service?
Yeah, there's a David Crowder song. It's sort of old, and it's like one of the B tracks. Not a lot of people know it, but he just says out loud in the song, "I'm just trying to get you to sing." Like that's, and I think that's the heart of a worship leader, right? I'm not up there to show off. I'm not that good. But the reason that the band is there is because we're trying to get these people to sing. So I think there's two considerations you have to take. If that's your goal, then one, you absolutely have to pick songs that have simple enough melodies that people will grab them and are in a key that's accessible enough for people to join you, because really you want, it's their voices. You're trying to give them vocabulary and give them the platform to lend their voices and to be the ones that are doing the singing. But there's another consideration. I think some worship leaders miss it, and that is we also want to keep things fresh, and we want to keep things artistic and beautiful. And so there's a level of artistry that comes even in complexity. So I'm not afraid of some songs that have more complexity to them, as long as that's not the main thing that we're feeding people. It's sort of like we give them things that they can grab a hold of, and then we still stretch them beyond that to something maybe even more beautiful. Maybe they can't grab onto that lyric right then, or they don't understand it right now, but it'll slowly dawn on them, and it just helps them to even be growing in creativity or in their own expression. So I do absolutely aim at very accessible songs, but I'm not afraid of sort of pushing the envelope every once in a while.
Mm-hmm. What's your approach regarding remaining faithful to a song's original recording versus taking artistic license?
Yeah, I feel freedom to use artistic license almost all the time. And I find we're being most successful when the musicians feel a sense of ownership, when they can express the creativity that God's given them through the song. So I don't like to put limitations on how creative we can be. Yet I do also love some songs. I think the recording artists have done so well with the song that altering it actually dilutes it. And so it's probably better to leave some songs in the feel or the same sense that they are recorded. The song's just sort of begging for that. But then there are other cases where I think creative license really allows for just a more powerful expression. So if I was leaning on the side, I say we always try to learn the form first, but then once we've nailed the form and we really understand it, then I want to find freedom within that form and to find a unique expression.
Mm-hmm. How do you typically approach memorizing lyrics and chord progressions?
Yeah. So what's interesting is I've had an easy time doing that myself, but I found other worship leaders have a hard time memorizing so many lyrics. And at first I just would tell people, try and do it like me. And I realized that doesn't work. For whatever reason that God made me the way he did, one of my unique quirks is that I have really bad visual memory, and words and reading things, it doesn't help me. Like when I think about where a verse is in the Bible, I can't picture the words or the letters, but my wife is very visual. So when she thinks about a verse in the Bible, she's like, oh, it's on the left-hand side and the bottom paragraph, the second line, like she can just see it in her memory. I can't do that. But I feel like God sort of wired me to be compensating for that in another way. Whenever I say something out loud or hear something often, it just sticks in my brain. So it's really easy for me to memorize lyrics. I don't have a hard time doing that. What I've encouraged other worship leaders to do is to get away from their sheet music as early as possible, and in their own personal time, just get used to turning that music stand around so you can't even see it, and then play through or sing through the song. I think we're so much more effective when we're away from our music stands. I think they're sort of like an anchor for us, and it helps us to engage with the congregation. But we just have to do the woodshed of rehearsing and practicing over and over till we have it memorized.
And do you find that's the same with chord progressions? You don't have a difficult time memorizing those?
Yeah, for me personally, I think because I'm not a really talented guitar player, I got used to playing by ear rather than actually learning the music or the notes, reading tablature to get my part down. And I find for me, whenever I get my guitar, and if I just play the song and sing it by myself in my office with no sheet music and record charts in front of me, if I do that about two times, I'll have the song. I'll have the chord progression down. Sometimes when we have new songs that are really wordy, I will on stage keep an iPad close at hand just so I can glance down. Remember, verse 4 starts with this phrase, you know, like something like that. And there are other songs where they have really strange, like, bridge sections that just have unusual chording. So sometimes I'll keep that just a glance at it to refresh my memory. But in general, I don't have too hard a time with the chord progressions.
Mm-hmm. When you are performing, do you normally use a click track? And any thoughts on using one for somebody new, for example?
Yeah. So for a while, I felt like using a click track would be limiting. Oh, now we have to stay with the tempo. We have to, if you have the backing tracks or the stems that are playing along with the song, then you have to follow the exact same pattern. And I know Ableton and other software have had great advances in adding freedom to the use of those click tracks and the stems. My sense was, I'd feel limited by that, but there were some benefits, so we began using them at church. And what I found is that I don't feel limited by them at all. I find that they enhance the unity of the band, they enhance our confidence, and I feel like we're actually better musicians for using them. So I try to use them as often as I can. I find it just to be a normal part of our worship plan. And even on some songs when we don't use the click, I have some percussionists, some drummers who are like, I feel uncomfortable without the click now, because it's just become another part of the very foundation of how we mm-hmm. play.
And who do you have control the click? Is it the sound man, one of the musicians?
Yeah, I've gone back and forth on that. There are some ways to control it as a worship leader through MIDI-controlled foot pedals, and I've looked at that and entertained that thought. And sometimes I wish I did have control of it. Sometimes, because I could start the song, and in my own, I don't have to talk to myself. I know if I start the song, I've got three sentences to say that work for that introduction and before we start, you know, the intro riff. So I just feel like I would have a good sense of that timing. But I also feel, because I'm playing from electric mostly, and I've got my whole pedal board in front of me, and I'm in transition, sometimes I just have too much going on. Thinking of the lyrics of the next song, turn off my delay, add distortion, switch my pickup, and start the click track would just be too much for me
too
sometimes.
Too much tap dancing.
Too much tapping, too much brain power. I don't have that much bandwidth. I need like a memory upgrade or something. And until recently, we've been using all volunteers for the front of house. And it's just recently that we've got a full-time technical director, and I've started entertaining the thought of having him start the clicks, just in that trust of they've got it. They're going to start it at the right time. They're aware of what's happening on stage. I haven't really felt that till now, but I haven't felt it enough to actually give control to the front-of-house guy yet, but I might do that in the near future. So we landed on the drummer doing the clicks and triggering the songs. He's got a MIDI-controlled drum pad that's synced up to Ableton, and he just launches them all before each song and works through the flow. I've really enjoyed using Ableton because it allows me to link songs together, so we get better flow throughout the worship service, but still the drummer's the guy in control.
And why the drummer? It might be a silly question, but why pick him?
I think a lot of our songs they have drum starts. And so then I just know if he's triggering it, he personally is ready for the beginning, whatever may come. I also, because he's got so much gear around him already, it just sort of adds in as another piece of the drum set. Mm-hmm. So it's going there. And because the drums are so foundational, I mean, really they're the rock that we're all sitting on anyway. So to give him the control over the click seemed like a natural choice.
Makes sense. You probably have volunteer musicians wanting to serve quite often. How do you determine if they're ready to participate?
Yeah. So I have friends who are worship pastors, and I think it's a problem that every church experiences, that there are people who are eager but maybe not prepared. And there's also sometimes the need for musicians, but a lack of prepared ones to use. Mm-hmm. So I heard it said that it's not a leadership problem that we have, it's a leadership development problem. And I think having systems in place to help musicians develop before they're ever invited to the stage is an essential part of the worship ministry. The worship ministry is too small. Our vision's too small. If all we're thinking about is the stage on Sunday, we have to see all these myriad of opportunities for people to play in high school and college and in like a one-time-only band or even just in a jam session. All of those different opportunities start shaping people and helping them to prepare to be able to play at a very high level on Sunday morning. So when people are eager to play, I'm always happy to meet with people and try to do whatever I can to have just sit down conversations with people, time to jam together and just get familiar with where they are musically. But if they're eager but not ready, I'll just add them into that pipeline of different opportunities. Maybe it's a jam night. Maybe it's come help in this band that's a developing band. Maybe it's go take some lessons and come back. But I'll offer them an opportunity to improve their skill. But I'm very jealous to guard that invitation to come play on Sundays. I really want to see a culture of excellence, and I think that by being slow to say yes to people, it actually helps the whole worship ministry.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever had to let musicians go from a worship team? And if so, do you have suggestions for some of the newer worship pastors?
Yeah. So it depends on the reason. Like, what you should do varies based on the reason why you have to let them go. Maybe you have someone on the band and they're just musically not performing where you'd like them to, then I think that's time for an honest conversation with them and some encouragement. Give them specific measurable goals to move toward and a timeline to do that. And I think if you can have that kind of hard conversation with someone, you actually are serving them. You're actually helping them to improve. I think there's been a couple of times that I've had to have conversations like that. And usually what I do is I build into the worship ministry some rhythms where there are natural breaks, where we have like a sort of a natural end time and a restart time. And I'll usually have those conversations on those natural rhythms of like serving for a year or serving for 6 months. And then it just becomes a normal time of evaluation and a way to help people to keep improving. I think the harder, more heartbreaking ones are where I've seen people they've just hardened their heart against God. They're just going to go live a life in open rebellion to God. And I, as their shepherd, have to correct them. I had a bass player and a keyboard player who ended up having an affair, sleeping. They broke their marriage vows. And I had to ask them to step off the team out of love for them, because I didn't want them just to keep going in their sin. I wanted to say, you cannot you're hurting yourself, you're walking away from God's best for your life, and I can't endorse that, nor can I let you lead the church and to be in that position of influence. And it was heartbreaking because they were my friends and I love them, but I removed them from playing as a step of discipline, hoping that they would grow and repent and come back to the best for their life. So
yeah, that sounds really hard.
Yep.
On a lighter topic.
Yeah.
How have you seen contemporary worship music change during your career?
Oh, wow. I'm old. So contemporary worship music when I started was I Love You, Lord, and Lord, I Lift Your Name on High. And those were cutting-edge songs. And you could not play them on Sunday morning. You could only play them on Sunday night services. And then only once a month when it was a youth service. When I was a kid going to high school camps and we had worship stuff and sing-alongs, I think the songs were really music. Well, they were bad. They were just not great musically. There was not a lot of dynamic, not a lot of contrast, not a lot of creativity. I sort of broke open one of my books, like my three-ring binder with old chord charts in it, and just looked at it thinking, would I play these songs today? And my answer was absolutely not. I couldn't do it. You know, there are maybe like three exceptions to that. You know, like there's like I Exalt Thee. You know, I think that's still usable. Mm-hmm. You know, there's like there, but it's like nostalgia thinking back. But the bulk of the songs that I used to lead worship when I was a teenager, I don't think that they have enough substance to them spiritually, and I don't think that they're creative enough musically. And so there are far better options to choose today. I've seen the depth of musicality and theological the theological import of our worship songs, I think, has really grown. And I appreciate songwriters that are writing such biblical, heartfelt, passionate lyrics, and it's in songs that have intricacy musically. And so I see there's been a really big, dramatic change in the mainstream of writing worship songs. I think you can still find really bad worship songs out there, but I think the difference is today there are so many that are really good.
And what do you think facilitated that shift, that dramatic shift in quality?
Yeah, I think a part of it is just culturally. Music has gotten more intricate. If you think about the Beatles to Coldplay, right? There's like a big shift. I mean, I'm not saying anything bad about the Beatles. I absolutely love the Beatles, but and there's amazing stuff that they were doing, but some of their earlier works were more simple chord progressions, and I think even they progressed as they went along with some amazing intricate stuff. So I think there's just like a maturing in that industry, and I think some of the worship songs at the beginning just needed to mature, and now we're hearing so many different artists who are writing still very accessible songs, but I think just deeper.
Well, I've learned a lot from this. My final question is, do you have any closing thoughts, anything you want to bring up?
Wow, I wasn't ready for that one. That's like a freebie. No, just to say that it is such an important role in the church to be a worship leader, and that what we're doing, it has eternal value. We're proclaiming the gospel to people, but I think we're even doing more than that. I think we're making disciples who will in turn be proclaiming the gospel to others, because we're giving them these vocabulary. We're giving them these words to say, and they find those sort of resting in their heart, and I think that's going to shape the way they speak to other people in the future. So Choosing great songs and really just elevating the role of leadership in the church. I think that as worship leaders, we are absolutely having an eternal impact, far more than just songs and music and guitars. And so I want to encourage more and more people. I want to encourage the next generation of worship leaders to work hard and serve long. And lead well.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time, Scott. I appreciate it.
Yep.
Thank you for listening to this Sonic Nuance Electronics podcast. Please also see our blog at sonicnuance.com, which has more articles on performance, equipment, as well as interviews. SonicNuance.com has handmade rugged direct boxes with Phantom-powered chromatic tuners, as well as instrument and headphone extension cables. All products are designed, tested, and made in the USA for the ultimate in fidelity and durability. Sonic Nuance Electronics. Simply sound.